I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Another busy show ahead. Jerry Sandusky, the popular Baltimore sportscaster and Ravens radio play-by-play man, has written a memoir about his father, a longtime NFL coach whose career included sideline stints in Baltimore and Miami. Jerry Sandusky joins us in the second hour to talk about growing up in a football family, and we'll hear what he has to say about the Ravens season that begins September 7th. Up front, we hear about efforts to house and provide schooling and legal services for some of the thousands of Central American children who crossed the U.S. border with Mexico and ended up in Maryland. Plus, commentary by social activists David Miller and the Reverend Heber Brown on police community relations after Ferguson. First, the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you again from noon to 2 right here on WYPR, as well as WYPF and WYPO, and streaming online through WYPR.org. We thank you all for making Midday part of your day. In this first hour of the show, we'll hear about efforts to house and provide schooling and legal services for some of the thousands of Central American children who crossed the U.S. border with Mexico, including the nearly 3,000 who ended up here in Maryland. We'll be getting to that a little bit later in this hour. First, we turn to the subject of police community relations following Monday's funeral of Michael Brown, the Missouri teenager who was fatally shot by a Ferguson police officer on August 9th. The shooting of the unarmed teenager led to many things, demonstrations, of course, and an aggressive police response to protesters, big questions about police confrontations with young black men in urban areas across the country, and what's been called the militarization of police departments. For reflections on this still evolving story, I asked two men to join us here in the early going of this hour, David Miller and the Reverend Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore. First, we hear from David Miller, who's joined us numerous times in the past to talk about challenges faced by African-American parents, many of them single mothers, in raising boys. David, who we first met through the Urban Leadership Institute, earlier this year started the Dare to Be King project, its mission to engage boys and men of color for emotional development, family reconciliation, and academic success. David Miller, it's nice to get you back on the show.
Good afternoon, Dan, and to your listening audience.
David, what have you been thinking about, especially the last day or so with the Michael Brown funeral, in terms of what we've learned from this, if anything, where we go from here?
Well, my reflections have been deeply personal, one, because of the nature of the work that I do, and second, because I'm raising three children, one of which is a 14-year-old African-American male child. And so I know that historically communities of color have had major challenges as it relates to policing, the style of policing, and law enforcement. And so for me, raising a son and the vast majority of work that I do is with males of color across the country, a lot of the work that I've been doing even before the tragedy in the Michael Brown case is really working with parents, community groups, and young men of color around teaching them the rules of engagement when they encounter police. And the reason why I've been doing that work, Dan, is because at the end of the day, I want my son, who's a precious, exciting, intelligent young man, I want him to be able to live through a police encounter. And because of the history of policing across this nation, I have to not only teach my son, but other sons, what I call the 10 rules of survival, if stopped by the police, in hopes that those 10 basic rules will save his life and create a different kind of dynamic when my son and other sons come in contact with law enforcement.
What are your thoughts about this, David? I'm going to ask Heber Brown the same question when we speak with him in a few minutes. And that is, you know, balancing the need to fight crime, prevent crime, investigate crime with this delicate balance of avoiding confrontation as police go about investigating crimes, in neighborhoods that are sometimes besieged with crime.
And so I think we know that narrative of many communities that have alarming rates of crime, issues with substance abuse and other kinds of criminal activity that occur. But we also know the narrative that all too often innocent, unarmed African-American males are stopped, detained, brutalized, and even arrested. And so I think what ends up happening is most people would agree that the vast majority of police officers are good men and women who are doing a great job, who want to go home to their families at the end of the day. But we know when you look at the data that an alarming number of particularly black and Latino males and also females are illegally arrested, are illegally detained, and also are brutalized. And I think one of the things that is alarming to me and very frustrating is looking at a lot of the news coverage in Ferguson and in other parts of the country. We still have a young man, Michael Brown, a teenager, unarmed, who was laying dead in the street because he was killed. And it almost seems like we want to blame, in a lot of these instances, we tend to want to blame the victim. Michael Brown didn't have a gun. He was unarmed, and from all reports, he was a reasonable distance away from the officer when the officer pumped 6 bullets into his body. And so while there's some facts, Dan, that we may not know, I mean, there are some other facts that we may not know. When we look at some of the other facts that we do know, here we go again, another unarmed African-American male who's laying dead in the street from six bullets.
So when you go about doing your work now under the umbrella of Dare to Be King, the Dare to Be King project that you've started, I suppose this issue is going to be right there in front of you even more so than it has been in the past when you speak with boys and young men.
Well, it's always been a major focal point of discussions because parents consistently bring it up. How do I prepare my son to navigate in a toxic society, particularly a society that oftentimes in its action consistently shows a bias toward African-American males? We tend to forget about cases like Sean Bell. Sean Bell was coming home in New York City in 2006 from a bachelor party. 50 bullets were pumped into his car. He didn't have a gun. He didn't have a box cutter. He didn't have a razor. Oscar Grant, and I'm working with the Oscar Grant family. Oscar Grant, unarmed African-American male, shot in the back while he was handcuffed on a subway platform in the Bay Area. And so Dan, these issues are consistently. Yesterday, 2 days ago, marked the 25th anniversary that Yusef Hawkins was killed in Bensonhurst, New York City. And so I can cite case after case after case where unarmed African-American men have been killed, and it's problematic.
David, thank you very much. The Dare to Be King project of David Miller, you can find out more information about its mission on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. We thank you for being with us again, David. Come back and visit soon.
Thanks, Dan.
We turn now to the Reverend Heber Brown III, a community activist and pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, joining us also to reflect on Ferguson the day after Michael Brown's funeral. Reverend Brown, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Was there another vigil held last evening in Baltimore?
Yes, there was a vigil last night in Baltimore. I was not able to attend, but there was a vigil for Michael Brown and also for Dante Bennett, a young man who also was killed here in the city. The corner of Caroline and Monument Street yesterday. In fact, I was attending the life celebration of life for Dunbar Brooks, who many of your listeners will remember as one of the community servants and educators of the city and state.
Right. Well, tell me this. You heard my question to David Miller, similar to you. First of all, where do we go from here? In an essay that you wrote that it was published in the Baltimore Brew, one of the suggestions that you seem to think makes sense is for people in the community to start keeping better tabs on the police, photographing them, using their cell phones when police have confrontations with young men in neighborhoods.
Yeah, I stand by that. And in fact, I have some even additional quick short-term solutions. I'm glad to see momentum growing around this idea on cameras on police officers. The Baltimore Fishbowl reports that cameras will cost about $2,000 apiece, and that's nothing compared to the millions of dollars that Baltimore City spends every year on police misconduct settlement cases. I'm hopeful that the public will get behind supporting grand juries in Baltimore. The general public needs to pressure the mayor and the incoming city state's attorney to throw support behind impaneling grand juries more often in the city to deal with controversial cases. And then, finally, in terms of a short-term solution, I think it's just time, Dan, to abolish the Civilian Review Board. It's never lived up to its initial promise and now serves as a source of agitation and a regular reminder of the failures of the justice system. I believe that local community associations and organizations need to develop their own civilian review boards, and that leads to the solution or the idea that I wrote about in the Baltimore Brew in terms of communities developing their own policing programs and safety patrols, maybe quite similar to the ShamRim program and that operates in Upper Park Heights here in the city.
Now, my second question, the one I also posed to David Miller, I'd like to hear from you on this, and that is, you know, balancing the need to fight, prevent, investigate crime with, you know, respecting the rights of individuals in neighborhoods and avoiding confrontations with the police and avoiding a situation where we have citizens who just don't trust the police at all.
Yeah, I think a couple things need to happen. One, I think we must expand our definition and our concept of violence. Personally, Dan, I think it is horrendous and violent to historically and perpetually underfund schools in black, brown, and poor neighborhoods. I think it's violent to continually keep those who are coming out of prison locked out of opportunities for employment, I think, and housing. I think it's violent when businesses divest from communities and community members have to go to check cash-in joints and corner stores to get basic needs and services. And so I think all of that's violent. So I think if you want to really engage the interpersonal violence, how about make some investments that into the basic services and the basic qualities of life that anybody, black, brown, red, or yellow, would want for their families and for their communities?
Those communities need the police, though. Back to my question, though, about, you know, how far you go with this,
well,
to the point where people don't trust the police at all and are always questioning their behavior.
Well, I think you'll need the police quite less if there's more jobs in the community, better education, and a higher quality of life. And that's my thing. Decreasing the dependence on police, I think, is a step in the direction of engaging the issue that you pose. The perception will increase when police are not rushing to, you know, engage every little issue that occurs in the community. There's some things I think communities can do for themselves and perhaps should do for themselves. And you may still need police for some things, but I think there's over-reliance on police on to deal with the more systemic issues of violence when we really don't need police as much as they're being used in black, brown, and poor neighborhoods.
Reverend Heber Brown III, a community activist here in Baltimore and pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, thank you again for your time.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll take a break here, folks, our first break of this hour. When we come back, an update on the child immigration crisis. Over 60,000 unaccompanied children have crossed the U.S. border from Mexico since last October. Federal law may offer some of them protection, but without lawyers, how will these children, some merely infants, navigate the already burdened immigration system? A look at that issue and more when Midday continues. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Since last fall, more than 60,000 immigrant children have crossed the border of Mexico into the United States. Most are traveling here from Central American countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Maryland has taken in nearly 3,000 of these children since the beginning of the year. The majority have relatives in the area, but for those who don't, the state has been trying to coordinate with foster care providers to provide shelter. We're joined today by George Escobar, Director of Health and Human Services at Casa de Maryland, the Latino Advocacy and Assistance Organization. And also joining us is Megan McKenna, Communications and Advocacy Director at KIND, K-I-N-D. That stands for Kids in Need of Defense, an organization that provides pro bono legal services for these unaccompanied children. Legal issues, a big deal here, and we're going to talk about it in this hour with Megan. Megan McKenna, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us from KIND. And George Escobar, thanks for being here. Let's start with you, and let's get an update, George, on where things left off with Governor O'Malley trying to coordinate foster care in the Maine for some of these kids in Maryland.
Sure. As you mentioned before, I mean, we're talking about 2,800 kids that are now in Maryland as of the end of July. Now, keep in mind that 2,800 figure, those are kids that are basically have been reunited with their families and are now basically integrated into the larger immigrant community in Maryland. There are additional kids that will be coming, and that's what we're working on at the moment.
So there are other kids who don't have family here who need shelter. Is that it?
Right. There was an RFP, a request for proposals, put out by the Office of Refugee and Resettlement, which is really overseeing the resettlement and the relocation of these children. These children are transferred from the Office of Border Protection to the ORR office, who's in charge overall of their custody and their well-being. And we know at the end of last month there was some funding made available for various foster care providers across the country that may be eligible for taking some of these kids in that are under ORR custody. And in Maryland, we're looking at the governor trying to coordinate those services. We know there's about 9 different providers that have gone out for funding. And so he's trying to put together various work groups to look at this issue and to coordinate services both that are offered by the Department of Human Resources at the state level and also by community-based providers.
Last month, and in July, there were a lot of news reports about the federal government, that office that you referenced, looking for shelters for the kids who've been in shelters, overcrowded shelters at the border. And there was all this controversy about it as the feds looked at an office building in downtown Baltimore. They looked at an abandoned military facility in Carroll County. So has that search ended? Is the government, are the feds trying to find some other way of sheltering these kids while they wait their deportation hearings?
I mean, I think, again, there was a kind of a rush by the federal government to locate these facilities. And I think the mistake was they weren't going through local government. They weren't going through the state. They weren't going through the local county officials to really figure out what the best placement was. I think the feds were just in a rush to try to place these kids all over the country and, you know, made that mistake. Obviously, the Carroll County facility, you know, the governor pushed back hard on that, obviously, but that was after, you know, I don't know if you've seen, but graffiti was plastered all over the walls.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show. Oh, yeah.
Misspelled, by the way.
Yeah, right.
No ill eagles, and I don't know if any eagles are supposed to come to Maryland, but
we remember it well.
Right, but obviously, you know, I think that was just a miscommunication and lack of coordination between those various
facilities. Well, my question is, are they looking for that kind of a facility still? The feds still are?
Oh, absolutely. And the state is still trying to coordinate with the feds to locate those facilities. Now, you know, the need isn't as urgent. You know, that's what we're being told at the time, but right now. But obviously, you know, the state and the governor has really outlined his intention to try to find facilities and try to be as cooperative in this whole process as possible.
George, do we know how many additional children we're talking about?
You know, right now, as I mentioned, those kids that will come through the foster care providers, I mean, you know, of those providers that solicited funding, they're looking for placements for, honestly, you know, 100 kids here, 100 kids there. We're not looking at overwhelming numbers that are going to be placed here. You know, this community is a very vibrant, strong community. Every year we welcome new immigrants to the state. I think it's important to underline the fact that we're not talking about a wave that is going to overburden the social safety net, overburden services. We have a strong infrastructure, both here in Maryland and actually nationwide, to be able to deal with the situation. The key is how you deal with these kids in a humanitarian way as possible, and how do you connect them with the services that are available for them to access.
Now, the majority of the children that we've spoken about already, nearly 3,000, you said about 2,800, they've been placed with family members in Maryland, in the main?
That's right. Yeah, okay. That number comes from...
This gets me to Megan McKenna, because, Megan, just because they've been placed with family, that's not the end of the story, right? The children still have to be... Their immigrant status still has to be adjudicated. Right,
that's right. Each and every one of these children, regardless of age, are in deportation proceedings. And there are no public defenders in our immigration system. So a child as young, our Kine's youngest client right now is 18 months old. And these children are expected to find their own attorneys and mount a defense against the government, which is arguing for their deportation. And as you can imagine, it's virtually impossible for these children who are newcomers, don't speak the language, don't know the system whatsoever, to be able to present their case in our complex, very complex immigration system, which attorneys have a difficult time with.
And a system that was already overwhelmed before these children started arriving.
Yeah.
Some say broken.
Yes, the system as a whole has been broken, and even in the case of the adjudication of the cases, there's been a backlog in our U.S. immigration courts that has predated the crisis, and this crisis has compounded that, and that's because we're underfunding the U.S. Adjudication system and focusing our resources at the border, but not following through and actually helping see through these cases to completion.
Megan McKenna is Advocacy Director at KIND, that she just referenced there, K-I-N-D, Kids in Need of Defense. Is this a nonprofit organization?
That's right.
Providing legal services for kids in these proceedings? Was it invented, created just for children in the immigration process?
Yeah, we're the only national organization that works solely on behalf of unaccompanied children. We were founded in 2009, and at that time there were an average of 6,000 to 8,000 children, unaccompanied children, coming every year. And as George said, now there are 60,000 and possibly more next year. We'll have to see. And the system as it was before this emergency did not handle the children particularly well. There were challenges, but now that system is completely broken down, and we have many concerns for these children and their due process and the fear that they would be sent back to their home countries without a fair hearing is paramount in those.
Death by deportation was the headline of a Baltimore Sun editorial a couple of days ago, establishing in the editorial from earlier news stories that some children that we have deported already have been killed.
Yes, we've heard news reports of that, and we have partners in the advocacy community has reported that children who are returning, and they've already deported children and their young mothers, a number of them, are returning to their deaths. And there's no question that without legal representation and without the ability to make their case for U.S. protection, we will be sending children to great harm and even to death.
I wrote a column a couple weeks ago about this, saying that the world has a refugee crisis. The Middle East has a refugee crisis. Parts of Europe are seeing refugees now from the Middle East and from Africa, have been for a long time. We have a refugee crisis, and actually some people challenged me in the use of that term, refugee. How do you feel about it, George Escobar? The use of that term. Do we have a refugee crisis?
I think it's appropriate, because when you look at how to deal with this situation, you have to deal with the underlying factors that led to that crisis in the first place, right? You can't deal with just one part of a situation of an issue that involves multiple stakeholders, multiple countries, multiple reasons for it to occur in the first place, right? We know that most of these kids are fleeing violence that's occurring in their home countries. This is violence, and let's be honest here, this is violence that was exported from the United States. This is gang violence.
For those listening, might wonder, what do you mean exported from the United States?
Well, that's a very good question. During the 1970s, 80s, and even up into the early 90s, the United States took a very aggressive stance towards deporting gang members all across the southwest of the United States, principally Texas, Arizona, but principally from Los Angeles. Most of those young adults learned how to be a gang member. In fact, even adopted the names of the streets that they lived on as their gang kind of insignia. Then they were deported instead of being prosecuted through the criminal justice system here. They were easily deported and quickly transported to their countries of origin: El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. These are the three countries that are the sources of these kids fleeing violence. These kids that are coming, streaming across the border, are fleeing that gang violence that's overtaken their hometowns. This situation has overloaded the local public security system, and really local governments are struggling to try to keep tabs on it. I mean, in order for us to really find a solution to this problem, we have to engage with those partners. We have to engage with our partners across the continent, and we have to find a way to institute international policy that at the same time isn't paternalistic and interventionist in its order. That is the reason why we got into this situation in the first place.
Megan McKenna from Kind Kids in Need of Defense, do you agree with the use of the term refugees?
Yes, absolutely. There are the UN has found recently that 58% of the children who are coming, unaccompanied children coming to the United States, are potentially eligible for U.S. protection, and that means that they are refugees. Not all the children are refugees, but the majority are, according to the UN and to other organizations, including Kind, who works with these children and is focused on their cases. So absolutely.
Could you just go over the process so we all understand that? 7 or 8 year old children, a group of them come across the border. They're intercepted by CBP, the Customs and Border Patrol, right? And then they're taken, let's say it's in Texas somewhere. They go to what's supposed to be a temporary shelter. And what happens to them after that?
They are after in CBP custody, and these are children from non-contiguous countries to the U.S. Children from Mexico are treated differently, and I can explain that afterwards. But these children are then put in the custody of Health and Human Services, and that's some of the shelters that we've been hearing about in the news. Mm-hmm. And from there, HHS tries to find a sponsor with whom to reunify them. And
that could be a family member.
Yeah, exactly, as George was saying. And the large majority of the children nationwide, about 90%, are reunited with a family member. So it's they care for the child while they await the deportation proceedings. And then the child has to find an attorney, has to enroll in school, has to do all this without really any assistance and go through the process. Because once the children are released from HHS custody, there's really very little assistance to them.
If the sponsor is in Maryland or Minnesota, Massachusetts, the government transports the child there?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so they're with family. And as we said before, that doesn't end the legal process for them. So they're all facing a deportation hearing at some point. And the reason Kind exists, Kids in Need of Defense, is because they don't have lawyers.
That's right. So at this point, before the emergency, there were about half of these children did not have attorneys, and now we believe about 70 to even 90% of the children are going forward in these proceedings without attorneys. And the children are being put ahead on the top of the docket now, so these cases are proceeding very quickly and in a much abbreviated time. And so it's even more difficult, if not impossible, for them to find attorneys. And even if they happen to find an attorney through Kind, or another organization, it's very difficult for the lawyer to mount a defense. And Kind has had works with pro bono attorneys in the private sector, from lawyers and corporations and law firms across the country. And we've had great success, and the private sector has been very supportive. But in the face of this great need, it's difficult to ensure that all the children will have an attorney.
And is it because of the speed of the system that has sent these children back to the countries that they came from? At least 5 undocumented immigrants U.S. officials recently deported back to their homes in Honduras turned up dead at the morgue in San Pedro Sula. That's according to the report in the Los Angeles Times.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the families, the U.S. is deporting the families. quickly. And the children who we work with so far in this surge haven't gotten to that stage yet. But we're certainly watching to see. But again, it's paramount that these children have attorneys and are afforded due process and have a full and fair hearing.
In case there are any attorneys listening, a different column that I wrote a couple of weeks ago was about the Esperanza Center in Baltimore and their need for some help with these legal issues here in Maryland, because their hearings are held here in Maryland as
yes.
well. So I got a call from a couple of attorneys wondering, do I need to know immigration law? How, if I want to volunteer some time, and I have to, right, because I think all attorneys in all states, at least in Maryland, have to do a certain amount of pro bono work. What about that? What if they're, you know, they're title attorneys?
Yeah,
what
no.
if the thing is torts? What do you
exactly?
What?
We have those attorneys and real estate attorneys and all of that. And all organizations work differently, but we train and mentor our attorneys across the country. And so far, we've been able to train about 7,000 attorneys nationwide. And the idea is to try to create a pool of pro bono attorneys who are have expertise in helping and representing unaccompanied children.
Another question for George Escobar about the children who have arrived here in Maryland. School is starting. What's going on there? We had a story in The Sun, Liz Bowie's story, about the system being, in some places, being a bit overwhelmed with children who can't speak English, obviously, and then some older children, the teenagers who not only can't speak English, but are way behind in school compared to the children who are resident here.
No, obviously, but I think that's also an indication of where we are demographically. You know, I think sometimes, you know, we can't blame all of these issues on one particular crisis. You know, we are seeing a significant demographic shift all over Maryland, and we are seeing an increased need for ESL teachers and ESL instruction. And things of that nature, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? I think, you know, right now we are seeing some schools have an easier time of enrolling these kids than other districts. Obviously, you know, the bulk of the population in Maryland resides in Montgomery County and Prince George's County. Obviously, their systems are going to be a little bit more quick to respond to this crisis and this upsurge in the enrollment. But even in those counties, you know, we're seeing the numbers start to come in. We're not seeing a whole huge amount of these children being enrolled at the time. We're looking at a couple of hundred kids right now. I think Montgomery County has accepted maybe around 300 kids that are coming from those particular three countries that are affected. Prince George's has similar numbers. Those numbers are a little bit less in Baltimore County, in Baltimore City, and Anne Arundel County. But there's obviously an impact, and there's obviously a bigger demand now for those kind of services, and particularly mental health services, because these kids have been through trauma.
I want to ask you about that. Actually, let me turn to Megan McKenna on that issue. In addition to the needs they have for housing and education, what about the trauma that they've been through, the psychological impact of this journey on the children and their experience at home?
Yeah, I'd say nearly all the children who KIND works with have been traumatized by what they left in their home country, what they experienced in their journey to the United States, and even in the United States, even in U.S. custom or custody. Our children talk a lot about forced gang recruitment, and that if they don't join gangs, and many of these gangs have control over large parts of these countries, they will be killed, and they're targeted for violence. And we've had a number of stories where our children are attacked, or they are threatened, and possibly a relative or a brother or is killed, and the child has there's no protection against these gangs in these communities. So there's no other option but to leave the United States. And the children say it's often flee or die. So it's not really a choice that they have to make. And girls as well are in some cases kidnapped by gang members. We just have a case that I was looking at today where there is widespread rape, and again, there's nowhere to go in the community or in the country even to protect themselves from this, and so they come to the United States.
The Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008 requires Customs and Border Patrol to ask certain questions to determine if children have been trafficked or if they fear returning to their home country. Do we know if that question is asked on a regular basis? Is it done by the CBP?
Yeah, and again, this brings me back to the children from Mexico, which I wanted to point out to, too, because children from Mexico are a little different. In the TVPRA of 2008, in their case alone, CBP screens them to determine if they're a trafficking victim, if they're at risk of trafficking, or if they express a fear of return. And if CBP, who is not trained in child welfare, not trained in dealing with traumatized children, and in a very short period of time, does not determine any of these factors, then the Mexican child can be returned right around the border into the hands potentially of traffickers. We don't know. And the children, other children from non-contiguous countries other than Mexico, they are meant to be sent directly to HHS, and they have a different process. But what's important to know is the changes in the TVPRA, which have been suggested and will probably come up again, are absolutely unnecessarily and would ensure that all children are treated like Mexican children, and that is not a standard that we want to adhere to.
That's what the Congress tried to pull. I think the House of Representatives tried to pull off the quicker deportations that President Obama is resisting, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And one last thing, Megan, before I let you go, I have to ask about the 18-month-old. How did an 18-month-old get here? Can you just tell us in brief that story?
Yeah, very, very quickly. The mother was here, and I think it underscores the desperation that these families are facing. The child was living in very dangerous circumstances in a community that was controlled by gangs, and she had no protectors from these gangs. So a smuggler brought the child to the United States, and for a mother to trust her 18-year-old child with a smuggler, 18-month-old, yeah. Right. It's hard to say because it's unbelievable, with a total stranger, just, again, underscores the desperation of these families.
Megan McKenna is Communications and Advocacy, Director at KIND, that's Kids in Need of Defense. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And George Escobar, so we're hoping to see a couple of more places in Maryland take in 100 or so kids here, 100 or so kids there, maybe a total of how many? Do we have any idea?
We're not really sure at this point until the Office of Refugee Resettlement announces those plans. But one thing I wanted to just highlight is you know, Maryland has a long history of being a welcoming state. It is a very progressive state. It is a very friendly state to immigrants and has a long history of such. So I know there's a lot of people out there that may be interested in helping these kids through this traumatic event. We've talked a lot about the negative things that are happening and, you know, some of the stuff that happened in Carroll County. But, you know, one thing I just wanted to say is if you go to the website, the Maryland website, maryland.gov, you'll find a link there on how you can help and where you can, because these kids have a variety of services, whether it's shelter, food, clothing, all the way up to foster care, which is a serious commitment. You'll find information there on exactly how to go about contributing to this.
Thank you for being here, George. George Escobar is Director of Health and Human Services at Casa de Maryland. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take another break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about the driving force motivating children to come to the U.S., the threat of gang violence as seen by a member of a Baltimore church that has been sending delegations to a Catholic parish in San Salvador for 25 years. This is Midday. Dan Rodericks, a short break. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Thanks again for listening in today. Barbara Cook is with us, a member of Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church. A group from that church recently traveled to El Salvador and witnessed how gang violence has affected families there and caused a lot of the problems that we've been discussing, the crisis of children, refugee children, migrant children coming across the border. Brown Memorial, by the way, as I said, has been sending a delegation to this country for 25 years. Barbara Cook, it's nice to have you on the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Just to note a little bit more about Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian. Would you call it a sister parish in El Salvador?
Yes, María Madre de los Pobres in an urban, poor urban community.
What does that mean? Let's see.
Maria, Mother of the Poor.
Of the Poor. And has the whole history of Brown Memorial's connection to that country related to that parish?
Essentially, yes.
Catholic parish. And how recently were you there?
I was there at the end of June with a youth delegation from Brown Memorial and our assistant pastor, Tim Hughes.
What do you do when you go there? What's the point of having this connection over the years?
So we've been going there for so long that we have good friends down there, and we go back to see them, and we bring church members with us to help them see what's going on in El Salvador, help them understand that their world here is very different from the world in San Salvador. We sometimes engage in projects. We always visit our godchildren. The church has a program where we sponsor children in the parish to go to Catholic school. For $300 a year, that pays for their education, uniforms, birthday presents. So you
support a school there?
We support children, individual children in the school. So we visit their homes when we go down there. And that was just incredibly enlightening to our seven young people who were 16 and 17 years old to visit in these homes.
Can you describe, is it La Chacra?
Yes.
La Chacra, which is a slum in San Salvador.
It started out as a garbage dump, and at the end of the Civil War, refugees were coming back into San Salvador, and they settled there. Nobody really wanted that property, and over the past 25 years, they've turned it into a large community of about 6,000 people, and Maria Madre de los Pobres is the parish for that community.
What is it like? Can you describe that for us?
Well, it's sort of the typical Central American slum with inadequate water. A little bit of electricity throughout the parish, some dirt roads, some paved roads, places that are incredibly poor houses with tar paper shacks and tin roofs. Some people have been able to upgrade to concrete block houses with tin roofs. You see just a little bit of everything.
How many trips have you made there, Barbara?
I've made 5.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what you've seen in that time. Because the focus has been on the last year, right? We're coming up on a year since the government has been reporting a surge of children coming across the border. As Megan McKenna from KIND said in the previous segment, what was, 6,000 to 8,000 children per year that they were seeing now has really risen to the point where we've seen about 60,000 children coming from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador only since last fall, since about last October. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about how things have changed in the time you've been going there, about 5 years now.
So gang activity in that community has increased fairly dramatically. I think that two gangs were referenced in the last segment, the 18, which means 18, and MS-13. Those are the two gangs that control La Chacra. They've divided up that territory. The church itself is located in 18 territory. Many of the parishioners live in MS-13 territory. And what has happened over the past several years is that the gang activity has increased. It used to be safe for people to come from 13 to 18 to come to the clinic at Madre, to come to the school there, to come to the lab there. And now with the increase in gang violence, people cannot get to the church. So the church has had to set up satellite parishes throughout this
so
community.
So they're crossing one gang territory to get to another.
That's correct.
To a church in another.
Yes. So there's a bridge that separates one gang territory from the other, and they can't cross that bridge and come in to go to Mass at Madre, because if they're young people, they're likely to be gunned down or beaten up on the way. We have a young man who works in the godparent program who's been in the program for about 5 years. His house is very close to one of the gang lines. One day he went home for lunch, crossed the gang line to have lunch in his house, and on the way back was beaten up and nearly died. So that the gang activity has increased pretty dramatically. They're recruiting kids at a younger age, both boys and girls. We were in the home of one godchild who's 13, lives with his grandmother because his parents are up here working. And he has been recruited to go into a gang, and the life of his mother has been threatened in this country if he doesn't join. So the pressures are enormous.
Who's left there? Then I wonder who's left there. When you think back over 5 years, there are people who are no longer there. Have whole families left La Chacra?
In general, I would say that the men go first. And so you see a fairly matriarchal society. as things have gotten worse, women have been going up, and so the children are left in the care of grandparents, aunts, older uncles, and older grandparents. It's disrupted family life tremendously, so you have lots of separation. And then what happens here is that it'll be 7, 8, 9 years when a mother hasn't seen her child. That person will sometimes start a new life with a new partner here in the United States because she's unable to get back and see her own children in Salvador.
Now, I don't know if you've actually seen this yourself or heard stories about the children just leaving. Because that's the story of the past year, unaccompanied minors crossing the border, as children as young as 6, 5, 4, 3 years old. And we heard about one who's 18 months old that a smuggler took across the border. So are you seeing this when you visit, or is this something you hear from people?
We hear from people that's what's happening. We had a kid who was 15 who was planning on going up in the month of August, and we just said, don't do that. You'll never make it across the desert because it's so hot. But the families here in the States pay from $7,000 to $10,000 to what are called coyotes, to transport these children here. Half of it is paid ahead of time, and the other half once the child crosses
into this
country.
Where do they get the
money? They save it up here.
So the man leaves the family first and comes north, comes maybe even to Maryland someplace, finds a job, saves his money, and then they use that money to pay the coyotes?
Yes. The cost of this, of course, $7,000 to $10,000, with half of it being paid in advance, is a tremendous burden on the families.
Now, I wonder what your reaction is to some of the reaction to all of this in this country has been. Some people, according to polls, and we hear people say, you know, we have enough problems in this country, close the border down, send these children back where they came from. They're here illegally. So are their families. Speed up deportations, which was an idea that came from the House of Representatives just before they took their recess for the summer. Some people dispute whether they're refugees. The use of the word refugees, they question. So let me hear from you on that.
Well, I see a lot of these folks because I work at Hopkins and we provide medical care for a lot of these people. They are very hardworking folks. They don't want to leave their countries. They would rather be back home. Employment is a huge issue. They're unable to support their families. I have a lot of sympathy for them. My grandmother immigrated from Scotland when she was 18 years old to be a nanny in Boston. So I understand refugees, and I understand why people leave their countries of origin, because they want a better life. And I think that we need to be welcoming. That's what this country's all about.
Barbara Cook from Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church, which has this connection to the Catholic parish in San Salvador, right? And is the parish, by the way, I meant to ask this, we talked about La Chacra, the slum. Is the parish located in the slum or nearby?
It's located in the slum.
It's in the slum, okay.
And we support financially the work that the parish does. They have a clinic, they have a lab, they have a school, an adult daycare program, a night school. So they have lots of programs that we support financially from here.
And I guess you'll continue to have this connection with that parish.
They're our good friends. We're not going to abandon them.
Will some members of the parish take in some of these children or families that are fleeing El Salvador?
That's a very good question, and it's hard to know how we can do that. We have been investigating that, but apparently the only way to do it legally is to become a foster parent, and that's a whole sort of different process.
Or to become an organization that does that. Apparently, from George Escobar's comments, it sounds like they were looking to place children with organizations that are already doing that kind of work.
Yes.
But anyway, thank you very much for coming in to talk about this, Barbara.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.
Barbara Cook, a member of Brown Memorial Park Avenue Presbyterian Church, is speaking with us here. That's our first hour for Midday today. We're going to take a break, and then in the second hour of our show, we'll move on to another topic. Another guest, Jerry Sandusky from WBAL-TV, will be joining us to talk about his new memoir. We'll take a break here for lunch. Tuesday lunch is provided by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pastas, salads that are made fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with delivery nightly from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. So please stay tuned for the news coming up from NPR, and then we'll have the second hour of our show. I'll see you soon.